And far be it from me to say exactly how society should be reorganized. I'm, as you know, I wasn't going to go into money. Very skeptical of this notion of money that's intimately connected to the hierarchy, because, of course, money is hierarchically issued. And in every financial transaction, there is somebody who is in charge, the owner of the money, and a subservient party, the person who gets the money, if certain terms and conditions are met. So, pretensions to the contrary aside, is that actually very different from a master-slave relationship? Do you, as a money user, have any freedoms or rights that those who issue the money couldn't take away from you at the drop of a hat? Do you, as a citizen of a country, have any rights that those above you in their self-styled power structures couldn't take away at the drop of a hat? For evidence on this, let's consider the following essay by Maurice Riley. He doesn't state it, but I believe he was an MI6 officer, and there is a long-standing rivalry known to exist between MI5 and MI6, so we shall have to bear that in mind. He's writing, this was published in 1993, on the difference between the supposed and practical accountability of MI5, particularly with respect to telephone tapping, such as those which were carried out, we heard earlier, against the leaders of CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Secret Justice by Maurice Riley. Notwithstanding the existence of the 1985 Interception of Communications Act and the 1989 Security Service Act, unlike their counterparts in North America, Australia, and parts of Europe, British citizens have little protection against the misdoings of the security services. Glossy brochures cannot hide the fact that there is still no effective accountability of MI5. Following the introduction of the new Official Secrets Act, the government appointed Lord Justice Stuart Smith as the Security Service Commissioner, with responsibility, as chair of the Security Service Tribunal, to investigate public complaints against MI5. In his early 60s, the cello-playing Stuart Smith, Radley, Corpus Christi, and the Dragoon Guards, is regarded as a dull dog who, according to one prominent QC, if he is not of the establishment, he faces it on the periphery. I would not think he knew how to think other than in terms of the establishment. Stuart Smith said of his role that he would probably be a reactor rather than an initiator in this context. A legal colleague thought that he would not be looking for a first case to strike at the establishment, but if it floats across his snout, he will sniff harder. So far, Stuart Smith appears not to have sniffed anything unsavoury. Home Secretaries have refused to give any details of the work of the tribunal. David Waddington said that, quote, it was up to Stuart Smith, in consultation with the members of the tribunal, to determine what information might be included in his annual report to the Prime Minister, unquote. Since the Commissioner has defined his remit in the most conservative manner, the government has little to fear from disclosure of the tribunal's work and MI5 activities. The tribunal's deliberations have taken on a Kafkaesque quality. Stuart Smith has conceded that complainants alleging improper burglaries by MI5 will not be told if their property was searched in the event of the tribunal finding that the search was justified. This proved to be the same case with telephone tapping. In February 1985, former Security Service officer Kathy Massiter on Channel 4's 2020 Vision programme revealed that MI5 had conducted an illegal surveillance campaign against the CND movement, the miners and others. In the House of Commons, CND member and Labour MP for Peckham, Harriet Harman, asked the Leader of the House, John Biffin, "Will you confirm or deny whether I have been subject to political snooping from MI5? If I have been, will you arrange for me to see a copy of my file? Is it not the case that such snooping is outside the guidelines, since the information gathered on me clearly has nothing to do with national security? Mr. Biffin replied that he was not in a position to comment on what might have been the situation. The SDP Chief Whip and MP for Woolwich, John Cartwright, thundered, "When former long-service MI5 employees are prepared to state publicly that the security services have broken their rules by mounting clandestine operations against organizations and individuals who pose no conceivable threat to state security, is it not an issue which the House should have an opportunity to debate at the earliest opportunity?" The Speaker, Bernard Wetherill, however, refused to allow an emergency debate on the issue. John Biffin did promise a full statement on the subject, which was never made. The government was now in an embarrassing position, and a solution had to be found. It opted for an old and well-tried escape. After noting Massada's revelations, the government asked Lord Bridge of Harwich, Marlborough College, chair of the Security Commission, to investigate whether the Home Secretary had ever improperly authorised telephone taps. The scope of the inquiry was deliberately narrow, avoiding the possibility that MI5 had undertaken unauthorised tappings. Bridge, having studied 6,129 telephone tapping applications in 3 days, reported that all warrants between 1970 and 1984 had been correctly authorised. This bizarre and unbelievable conclusion elicited the response from the former Labour Home Secretary Roy Jenkins that Bridge had, quote, made himself appear a poodle of the executive, unquote. It was, inevitably, a whitewash. In the knowledge that MI5 had files on its leaders and staff, including Joan Ruddock, Bruce Kent and Roger Spiller, and that the files contained inaccuracies, CND wrote to the Home Secretary, Leon Britton, demanding to see the files and check on the reported inaccuracies. 6 weeks later, Joan Ruddock received a bland assurance from Britton that the Security Service had carried out no operation, investigation, surveillance or action against any individual other than for the purposes laid down in its directive and with the propriety which successive governments have rigorously demanded of it. In the following year, July 1986, CND went to court to challenge the legality of the telephone tap on Dr. John Cox, a vice president of the organisation. Backed by a sworn affidavit from Cathy Massiter, CND argued that the surveillance of John Cox and, through him, of two other officials, Bruce Kent and Joan Ruddock, broke the service's own rules, the Maxwell 5 directive. A warrant to tap Cox's telephone had been signed by Leon Britton in August 1983, after Massiter had been specifically requested by her superiors to discover a suitable candidate within CND for a tapping operation. She chose Cox, a member of the Communist Party of Great Britain, and therefore considered to be a subversive. However, according to Massiter, the service, quote, knew from our coverage of the Communist Party that he was not getting up to anything in CND. We knew exactly what their peace committee was doing, unquote. The absence of any threat was minuted in Cox's Security Service file. The Crown chose not to cross-examine Cathy Massiter, and instead argued that the court should not adjudicate, because it was contrary to the national interest to receive evidence or disclose whether a warrant had been issued. Crown lawyers also claimed that litigation was historic and academic, and therefore did not warrant the exercise of the court's discretionary power to grant relief. Clearly the litigation was not historic, as it only went back a few years, and it was far from being academic, as other cases could be in the pipeline. After 3 days of legal arguments on the merits of CND's case, Justice Taylor announced that he would reserve his decision until September, when he could give it in open court. In the meantime, in May, CND's solicitors submitted to the recently established Interception of Communications Tribunal the evidence that had been presented to the High Court. The tribunal replied in early July that there had been no contravention of Sections 2 through 5 of the Interception of Communications Act 1985, which had been introduced to put right Britain's unsatisfactory laws on telephone tapping. On the 2nd of September 1986, Justice Taylor delivered his judgment and rejected the claim by CND that the Home Secretary had acted unlawfully in approving a security service telephone tap on one of its officers. His judgment, however, conceded several major legal points in CND's favour. He rejected the government's argument that the court had no jurisdiction in matters of national security and in cases about whether or not a telephone tapping warrant had been issued. Following the introduction of the Interception of Communications Act, the government had barred appeals. Decisions of the tribunal shall not be subject to appeal or liable to be questioned in court. This is strange, given that ministers regularly assure the public that the judiciary will protect citizens' civil liberties and provide the necessary watchdog role over the security service, ensuring that it operates within the law. This is, of course, a delusion. The courts have very rarely challenged the executive on matters of national security. Lord Fraser, from Balliol College, Oxford, the senior law lord, stated in 1984,
"The decision on whether the requirements of national security outweigh the duty of fairness in any particular case is for the government and not for the courts. The government alone has access to the necessary information, and in any event, the judicial process is unsuitable for reaching decisions on national security."
Taylor, however, concluded that to restrict the court's supervisory jurisdiction in a field where the citizen had no right to be compensated for illegality would be a draconian and dangerous step indeed. Secondly, he agreed that the citizen has a right to relief if the government breaches its own criteria, the Home Secretary having a duty to act fairly in exercising his prerogative power. Thirdly, in spite of the government's submissions that the court should not be concerned with whether or not a warrant has been issued, the judge found that, on the evidence, a warrant had been issued to tap John Cox's telephone. However, he did not find any grounds for impugning the Home Secretary with malfeasance. He neatly sidestepped the main issue by finding Cathy Massetter's evidence insufficient to prove that the Home Secretary had gone outside the criteria as laid down, because
the minister might have been given other information in addition to Massetter's, who,
he suggested,
acted in a junior capacity in the security service.
Taylor could not say that the telephone interception had been illegal, because it had been quite properly authorised by the Home Secretary. In fact, the question of illegality does not appear to trouble the courts. In March 1992, the Court of Appeal dismissed an appeal against a conviction in which telephone intercepts made from a cordless telephone were not backed by a warrant and were thus illegal. Commenting on the Section 1 provisions of the 1985 Interception of Communications Act, Lord Justice Steyn, a Rhodes Scholar, University College, Oxford, said that
it would usually be perfectly proper of the Crown simply to decline to say whether a warrant was or was not issued.
In this particular case before the court, Steyn claimed that
the police officers were local officers who might not have been very familiar with the Act. It was not suggested that they deliberately contravened the 1985 Act.
All that mattered, claimed Steyn, was
the quality and content of the recordings.
It would appear that ignorance of the law is now an acceptable defence for MI5 officers engaged in illegal activities. The CND members did not take matters any further, but two former members of the National Council for Civil Liberties, now known as Liberty, also put under surveillance by MI5, decided to take their case to the Council of Europe. In April 1990, the verdict was finally delivered by the court in Strasbourg, which ruled that the British government had breached their human rights. It also agreed to award them costs of £50,000, courtesy of the British taxpayer. After the judgment, Harriet Harman, formerly an NCCL legal officer, said she thought it outrageous that the security service had created a file on her, stating, quote, "It casts a shadow over me which is unjustified and which I bitterly resent. I want my file destroyed. It's not just a technical breach of the rules. As the legal officer for the NCCL, I defended human rights, taking the government to court when they overstepped the line on civil liberties. I want the government now to act on the spirit of the judgment as well as abiding by the letter of it and destroy the files," unquote. She said the files could affect her future in a Labour government if she was passed over for a position because of the subversive tag. Patricia Hewitt, a former NCCL General Secretary and Secretary to the Labour leader Neil Kinnock, said the MI5 files included material gained by special branch surveillance and from telephone taps made on other people to whom the two women spoke. Quote, "I want to see the files and then have them destroyed. There is nothing we can do under British law as it stands. That is why we had to go to Europe." Unquote. Once the European Court had declared that the actions of the Security Service had breached Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which guarantees respect for private life, Hewitt and Harman expected their MI5 files to be destroyed. Liberty wrote to the Security Service Tribunal, which was set up under the 1989 Security Service Act, to investigate complaints to confirm the destruction of the files. It received, instead, a series of tortuous letters. The first, in July 1991, said the tribunal intended to treat the complaint as being that MI5 had unreasonably made Hewitt and Harman the subject of its inquiries after the Security Service Act came into force on 18th of December 1989, i.e. after the surveillance had, in fact, taken place. It went on to say that the tribunal had no powers to investigate, quote, "the assumed continued holding," quote, "of personal information. But when investigating whether inquiries post-December 1989 were unreasonable, it might use its powers under paragraph 7, section 2 of Schedule 1, i.e. to refer for investigation whether the service has or had in any other respect acted unreasonably. If it made no determination in favour of the complaints, i.e. if it did not uphold them. In this case, it would ask the Commissioner to investigate whether the Security Service has acted unreasonably, whether or not in breach of Section 2, by continuing, if they do, to hold personal information. Section 2 of the Act states that the Security Service Director General shall ensure that no information is obtained, except as necessary for the discharge of its functions in Section 2A. The functions referred to being the protection of national security from actions intended to overthrow or undermine parliamentary democracy by political, industrial, or violent means. By October 1991, the tribunal concluded that no determination could be made on the complaints, but it did decide to refer the matter outside of its jurisdiction. The alleged continued holding of personal information, in breach of Section 2, to the Security Service Commissioner. The letter ended by stating that this decision carries no implications either way as to whether the Security Service continued to hold or ever held personal information upon all or any of the complainants. And I'm going to stop reading there. You've got a sample of the rather tortuous letters by MI5. The letter comes back and says whether the security service has acted unreasonably, whether or not in breach of Section 2, by continuing, if they do, to hold personal information, so and so. So a complete refusal of the MI5 to follow the judgment that they've collected information illegally and therefore it should not be retained. The article continues. The judiciary have, in the past, turned a blind eye to MI5 misdeeds, even though Lord Denning claimed in his report on the Profumo affair that
members of the security service are, in the eyes of the law, ordinary citizens with no powers greater than anyone else.
Douglas Hurd, the Home Secretary who guided the Official Secrets and the Security Service Acts through the House of Commons, appeared to suggest that this was correct, admitting that MI5 had never had any powers to bug communications, open mail, or enter premises.
There have been no statutory provisions giving the Security Service special powers in this respect.
Douglas Hurd was not telling the whole truth. As Lord Donaldson admitted during the Spycatcher litigation,
it's silly for us to sit here and say that the Security Service is obliged to follow the letter of the law. It isn't real.
In the past, prerogative powers protected MI5 from prosecution and enabled Peter Wright and his colleagues to bug and burgle our way across London at the state's behest, while pompous bowler-hatted civil servants in Whitehall pretended to look the other way. Donaldson said that while
the Security Service is bound by the strict rule of law,
there is always
a prerogative power not to pursue criminal proceedings,
it was essential that any wrongdoing did not
deprive the service of the secrecy without which it cannot possibly operate.
In the public interest, MI5 officers would occasionally have to break the law, and this was acceptable. MI5 has always justified illegal telephone tapping by claiming that it was operated under the royal prerogative. In 1952, Sir David Maxwell Fyfe told left-wing Labour MP Sidney Silverman that MI5 was authorised to tap telephones on his authority under a
power which has been used by every government of whatever political faith since the telephone was invented and is a prerogative power.
5 years later, Lord Birkett, whose committee was investigating telephone tapping, was told that such actions had derived from
an ancient power derived from the actions of the monarchy when seeking to safeguard the realm.
In effect, the prerogative allows the crown to do anything it pleases, except where power has been limited by statute. This power, invoked by MI5 and ministers, is not, Neil Acheson has written, quote, something outside the unwritten constitution, but, on the contrary, is its inner backbone. It is simply the state, wearing a paper crown, doing as it pleases. Unquote. It was Donaldson's comments that persuaded the government to introduce the Security Service Act, which places MI5 within the law. This made a mockery of Lord Denning's grossly naive statement that the Security Service
cannot enter premises without the consent of the householder.
In effect, the Act gives authority in law to MI5 to break into ordinary citizens' homes, tap their telephones, and open their mail. Stuart Smith's reports have offered little protection to the citizen. He admitted that the Home Secretary was
dependent on the accuracy of the information contained in the application and the candour of those applying for it. This is, of course, essentially a question of integrity and quality of the people involved in the security service.
MI5's record on warrants, such as those based on erroneous information during the campaign against CND, provides no basis for such trust. So, at the end of the day, they're just a bunch of people, and they're doing what people do. Only they're special people, they have some kind of royal prerogative, usually not spelled out because you shouldn't be looking that close, because hey, who let you in here anyway?
I just bought me a congressman. He was cheaper than a Subaru. He needed money for his next campaign. Now he'll do anything I ask him to. 20 years on Capitol Hill. He pretends to do the people's will. But I got him in my pocket now. Well, that's the way the game is played. I got lobbyists in my pay. They're on the Hill nearly every day. Writing bills that the senator signed. They never read them, but I don't mind. Koch brothers bought a whole damn crew. They own governors and presidents too. Now they're working on the rich man's dream. 9 judges out of 9 supremes. Well, that's business in the USA. Buying senators is all the rage. Big money owns a whole damn show. And we the people get the shaft. But the people now are getting wise. You can see it in their angry eyes. Had enough of all the tricks and lies. And now they're loaded for bear. Party and the liberals too. Both stewing in the same damn stew. Big money screwing me and you. And it's time we change the game. So keep voting if you think you should. The illusion might do you good. But you gotta know the whole game's rigged. Politicians don't give a fig. We had enough of this plutocracy. We can't whine and just let it be. The whole Congress is a den of thieves. And we gotta send them home. So get your pitchforks and torches now. Well, that's the only way to push them out. Standing tall on the Capitol Mall. Raise a ruckus now and sound the call. We gotta get out on the streets today. Bare knuckles is the only way. We the people gotta have our say. And you better listen up. Well, that's business in the USA. Buying senators is all the rage. Big money owns a whole damn show. And we the people got the shaft. But the people now are on the rise. You can see it in our angry eyes. We had enough of all the tricks and lies. Now we're loaded for bear. We the people gonna have our say. And you better listen up.
Now, we conclude with the final part of the essay we read at the end of last time, Sins of Statecraft, The War on Terror Exposed, by Brian Bogart. What we are left with, then, with this long war to rid the world of evil, is a permanent state of defence build-up and preparation for advanced warfare, and other lucrative perpetual peaks of power assertion via real interventions and official and belligerent Pentagon strategies. It is not comforting that likely and so-called moderate presidential candidates, such as Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton, support the war in Iraq, or that Republican Senator John McCain, who speaks against torture, also stated that
the United States is the greatest force for good in the world. We have not an obligation to go out and start wars, but to spread democracy and freedom throughout the world.
Both views keep the past ghosts of our manifest failures alive to threaten our future while fortunes flow to the ruling minority.
Nafiz Ahmed writes, quote, coincidentally, the 9/11 attacks were ultimately fortuitous for the Bush administration, which was facing both a domestic and an international crisis of legitimacy prior to 9/11. Under the mantle of the new war on terror that followed the attacks, the government was able to significantly divert and reverse these trends. The domestic crackdown on basic civil rights, combined with the demonization of dissent, has arrived part and parcel with the granting of unlimited war powers, lending the U.S. state a free hand to embark on a new, unlimited war against any regime that challenges U.S. interests. Unquote.
In a Meet the Press interview, televised on March 2, 2003, Richard Perle was asked about the Bush administration's policy toward Iraq. Perle gave this reply.
If the whole world were democratic, we'd live in a much safer international security system because democracies do not wage aggressive wars. His associate, Michael Ledeen, asserts that
every 10 years or so, the United States needs to pick up some crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show the world we mean business.
Likewise, in an interview with Ted Koppel, William Crystal, co-founder of PNAC, along with Pearl Ledeen, Wolfowitz, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, justified the policy of invading Iraq.
This is a bold and ambitious American foreign policy. I think it's right for us and right for the world.
Another important perspective is voiced in a lengthy essay by Major Ralph Peters, which can be summed up in one statement.
There will be no peace. The de facto role of the U.S. armed forces will be to keep the world safe for our economy and open to our cultural assault. To those ends, we will do a fair amount of killing.
Outrageous in their arrogance, these quotes represent a euphoria descended from power and propelled through the cohesive and expanding, self-reinforcing and self-congratulatory nature of elite negative activist circles, wherein the motivation is not democracy, domination through force, geostrategic primacy, or even oil in and of itself. The motivating force common in all similar pursuits of empire is money and the maintenance of lucrative power, a natural product of escalating corruption in an almost totally unchecked government system, is the merging of corporate, military, and administrative forces. When these spheres are dominated by negative activist minority circles, and their deeds are disguised as acts of goodness, liberation, and protection, the total abuse of power becomes possible, if not inevitable. The majority, the people, in such a democracy, is irrelevant except as workers, soldiers, and voters to equip, expand, and legitimize democracies' imperial conquests for money and the maintenance of lucrative power under the fearful illusion of external threats. None of this is new. All of this has been refined over centuries. The only difference today is that the scope of negative consequences of empire, which presents the question of how long the Earth's ecosystem will tolerate empire's exhaust. Thanks to the complete failure of democracy in the American experiment, America's time, empire's time, has reached its closing act. There is no substantial residual value in America's founding documents, and very little real power left among the common people. All that remains is a countdown to catastrophe,
one or many, that may or may not allow the people to demand a paradigm shift.
Such a shift should begin with legal action against those who have neglected the people's general welfare in favor of a lucrative warfare state. The total U.S. withdrawal from the Kyoto Accords presents one such basis for legitimate action. The increasing defense budget, in light of the accompanying increase in carbon emissions through industry and conflict, presents another. The absence of any law that requires U.S. citizens to pay taxes from wages is clearly a cause for legal action. The contrast between reality and status quo rhetoric is both comedic and tragic, as illustrated by Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, David Chu, who, attempting to justify the raising of age brackets for Army recruitment goals, explained that upping the level to 42 is not a change in standards, because people are living longer these days. The other reason for upping the age bracket is that Donald Rumsfeld is turning 74 and becomes, quote,
quite offended when anyone suggests that 42 is old, unquote.
Chu went on to tout a 75-year-old service person who is currently on his third tour of duty. Typically, as empires end, their rulers become more ruthless and authoritarian, often using unexpected tactics. To illustrate this today, some neoconservatives are turning to the Democratic Party and speaking with green tongues about climate change, tactics to keep power by playing the current anti-Bush sentiment to their advantage. In any event, their installed neo-manifest destinarian military strategies stand to be honored by both parties beyond the tenure of this administration, while human nature as Noam Chomsky explains, may preclude the majority from stealing ice cream out of the hands of children, it obviously does not prevent the rise of equally reprehensible indicators among the minority inner circles of humans, motivated, when presented with seemingly irresistible opportunities for abuse, in the combined spheres of finance, warfare, and politics. In a speech to the House of Representatives in 2003, Republican Congressman Ron Paul of Texas highlighted the dangers of these three spheres of power. Quote, "Our obsession with policing the world, nation-building, and preemptive war are not likely to soon go away, since both Republican and Democratic leaders endorse them. Liberty is virtually impossible to protect when the people allow their government to print money at will. Inevitably, the left will demand more economic interventionism, the right more militarism and empire building. Both sides, either inadvertently or deliberately, will foster corporatism. Those whose greatest interest is in liberty and self-reliance are lost in the shuffle. Though left and right have different goals and serve different special interest groups, they are only too willing to compromise and support each other's programs. If unchecked, the economic and political chaos that comes from currency destruction inevitably leads to tyranny, a consequence of which the founders were well aware." Unquote. My final words of indictment against the negative activist minority involve a heart-wrenching event related to the film The Battle of Algiers, Al-Qaeda, and current Pentagon policy, in December 1991, some 26 years after Guido Pontecorvo made his landmark film, he was asked by Italian media to revisit Algeria and assess the situation in the context of the rise of the new political party, the Islamic Salvation Front, FIS, which had just won a landslide victory. During his visit, captured on film and available in a three-disc DVD set some 9 hours long, Pontecorvo interviewed the new president of Algeria, Mohamed Boudiaf, a former member of the National Liberation Front, FLN, that had been the subject of Pontecorvo's 1965 film. Boudiaf pointed to, and the documentary footage clearly shows, tremendous tensions within Algeria in the wake of the 1991 election. 1 week later, after Pontecorvo's arrival back in Italy, Boudiaf was assassinated. In The War on Truth, Nafiz Ahmed points out that
in December 1991, the Islamic Salvation Front, FIS, won a landslide victory in Algeria's national democratic elections. But before the parliamentary seats could be taken in January 1992, the Algerian military violently overturned democracy. The elections were cancelled, while the army rounded up tens of thousands of Algerian FIS voters into concentration camps in the middle of the Sahara. This was a dark day for democracy. According to Ben Lombardi, who's with the Directorate of Strategic Analysis at the Department of National Defense in Ottawa, Canada, quote, "In 1991, the West supported the coup in Algeria in an effort to prevent Islamic fundamentalists from coming to power through the ballot box," unquote. As noted by John Entelis, a professor of political science and director of the Middle East program at Fordham University in New York, quote, "The Arab world had never before experienced such a genuinely populist expression of democratic aspirations. Yet when the army overturned the whole democratic experience in January 1992, the United States willingly accepted the results. In short, a democratically elected Islamist government hostile to the American hegemonic aspirations in the region was considered unacceptable in Washington." Unquote. The new junta, in contrast, expressed willingness to collaborate with American regional ambitions, which included collaborating with Israel in establishing a Pax Americana in the Middle East and North Africa. Not long after the coup, hundreds of civilians were being mysteriously massacred by an unknown terrorist group calling itself the Armed Islamic Group, whose core members are thousands of Afghans, men who have received their military training from Afghanistan. The formation of the group was rooted in Al-Qaeda.
Ahmed goes on to state that the death toll from the massacres came to some 150,000 civilians, and that, according to Stephen Cook, an expert on Algeria at the Brookings Institute, there are Algerian terrorist cells spread all over Europe, Canada, and the United States.
Not surprisingly, Algeria's primary resource is oil. On August the 27th, 2003, the U.S. Directorate for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict arranged a screening of the Battle of Algiers for a top-level civilian-led group within the Pentagon. The flyer for the showing stated,
"How to win a battle against terrorism and lose the war of ideas. Children shoot soldiers at point-blank range. Women plant bombs in cafes. Soon the entire Arab population builds up to a mad fervor. Sound familiar? The French have a plan. It succeeds tactically, but fails strategically. To understand why, come to see a rare showing of this film."
A discussion followed the film, but no details were provided. The strategic lesson of the film is that torture by the French army ultimately cost them the war in Algeria, though they'd won the Battle of Algiers. Apparently, judging from Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and the process of rendition, the civilian-led group within the Pentagon failed miserably to understand why. Or did they? The result of French torture was that all Europeans became targets of the French army, which later admitted that it had planted bombs to provoke attacks on European settlers and thereby justify further urban warfare, and of the Algerian FLN, which had taken the war from the Algerian countryside into the urban setting of the capital to win public sentiment. Ultimately, such tensions produced a nexus that carried out horrific acts against both sides to prevent acceptance of a deal between the French government and the FLN. Herein we see the complexities, militarists would say the opportunities, of terrorism. This begs the question of who is killing coalition forces in Iraq and elsewhere. After all, though Westerners are the targets in the war on terror, who benefits most? Those who stand to gain and have the greatest motive are the Western minority rulers. Using financial and military powers against their own human assets, they reap perpetual profits and geostrategic victories. The human majority element is once again the only expendable asset. Such people are not power. They are pawns. Moreover, Guantanamo, by its very nature, breeds worldwide contempt, providing fuel for the fire. A far better strategic rationale for its existence as a place of torture than the official explanations offer. Again, there are three primary spheres of concern for rulers: financial, corporate economic motives; military, threats and demonstrations of force to pursue the motives; and political, manipulation of the people to achieve the motives. The latter is of no moral significance to the rulers. Manipulation is the operative word, whether the people are domestic or otherwise. Thus law is something to be circumvented or reinvented globally at any price and at every opportunity. Featured in the film, and its accompanying interviews, is the issue of French determination not to allow Algerians to form a strong allegiance to the FLN. In my December 2005 London interview with Iraq's Southern Oil Workers Union president, Hassan Juma, he clearly described how the U.S. occupation forces had rented at exorbitant costs all the halls and meeting places in southern Iraq, thus preventing unions from gathering to discuss the possibility of peaceful worker strikes against U.S. occupation. The U.S. also terminated the contracts of the majority of the oil workers and replaced them with non-Iraqis and Kurds, sowing further tensions. What appear to be acts of war between two distinct sides, in reality, can be something completely different. Where the rules of war were once applied, in today's world there is little such clarity, and opportunists rule the day. Where torture moved the French public to pressure the French government to establish Algerian independence in 1962, the memories of torture at the hands of Nazis or anyone else are today not present in the consciousness of Americans sufficient to produce the same scale of societal rejection. Meanwhile, as one interviewee emphasizes in Disc 3 of The Battle of Algiers, quote, torture only leads to revolt. Unquote. The battle of ideas is lost as hatred is sown. Thus, the American majority stand to bear the fallout of the acts of the American negative activist minority in power. Nafiz Ahmed's concluding thoughts reflect my own, and my words could not state them better.
Quote, the rise to power of the conglomerate of neoconservative factions represented in the Bush administration and its web of political, financial, and religious connections was, perhaps, merely the inevitable outcome of the very logic of the interests and operations of U.S. and Western power in the post-Cold War period. U.S. and Western military intelligence policy has consistently been conducted in a manner that is fundamentally unaccountable to meaningful democratic influence. The root of this problem clearly lies in the structure of Western power itself, which, although conventionally believed to be the epitome of democracy, is in reality conjoined to a sprawling network of overarching criminal and financial interests that tend to drive U.S. and Western foreign policies, and which, in the post-Cold War period, has driven the West and international terrorism into an increasingly dynamic and unstable, interconnected continuum of power. The criminalization of Western power and the corruption of Western democracy is therefore not a new phenomenon exclusively linked to the rise of the Bush administration. On the contrary, the Bush administration has merely followed through with the inner logic of the historical trajectory of the policies of previous U.S. administrations. The rise of the Bush administration simply demonstrated the extreme degree to which the criminalization of power has come to penetrate so deeply into the structure of society. It is therefore crucial to recognize that the cause of the problem here is not a particular group of individuals or a particular set of ideologies or a particular party's political program linked to the Bush or any other administration. The problem, which has plagued both Democratic and Republican administrations to varying degrees and has only grown increasingly entrenched with time, relates fundamentally to the structure of the international system which Western power dominates. It is these structures that generate the individuals, ideologies, and political programs that promote the climate in which international terrorism flourishes. Unquote.
As Alan Wolfe concluded in 1979, our task is to unmask the illusion of the threat so the underlying undemocratic and monopolistic economic program is revealed.
If Americans wake up to the danger posed from those within their midst who would destroy the best features of their country in order to militarize it against an illusory enemy, they have a chance to create the kind of future that they will then deserve.
Sadly, the trend of the movement against global economic injustice since the death of Dr. King, as I see it, has been near total dysfunction of the whole due to the self, and little more than group therapy in a burning house. This positive activist movement is dysfunctional because of the flailing and fragmented myopic approach that persists regardless if a true solution or a prime piece of the puzzle is presented. There is a myriad symptom-addressing peace movement when a narrow and more specific root cause exposure and unified approach is required.
though 9/11 was either an engineered pretext for assertion of power, a conveniently provoked trigger for assertion of power, or both. Either way, our government brought it on with imperial ambitions in the shadows of deception and public ignorance in a nation founded on power derived from the consent of its people. Such arrogant and long-standing policies of bullying and lying for corporate wealth remain, for the moment, traditional tools of U.S. foreign and domestic policy. But this fourth and permanent peak is, in the end, likely to prove fatal for the negative activist continuum, perhaps fatal for humankind itself. Regardless, the positive activist movement is on the verge of shifting into higher gear. Today, the world as we know it is in for a serious makeover, what David Corton calls the great turning from empire to earth community. The age of global economic injustice, driven by the greatest polluter, militarization, cannot survive its own methods. Globalization, militarization, corporatization, overpopulation, domination by a sole superpower, these conditions will be rendered obsolete by nature itself, and humans thus stand to experience a forced awareness quite soon. Those who recognize that time has nothing to do with humankind, who begin to demand a massive shift in priorities to attempt to offset and prepare for the severity of the consequences of empire, and who demand a new paradigm of coexistent cooperation, those who, in the words of George Washington,
labor to keep alive in their hearts that celestial fire called conscience,
and are willing to adapt, will be in the best position to do so. In the face of nature's vengeance, Dr. King's dream is still the only path forward. Gandhi's way of life is the way of the future. Our swift transformation from killers to caretakers will be the only means of surviving together the coming change. Humankind will carry forth a triumph of vision if we do survive. Not a triumph of human superiority, but a triumph of surrendering the concept of superiority to the higher power of cooperation, with a perspective of our place as caretakers of life. True security is the rejection of exploitative policies in favor of the selfless surrender of the ego as our personal engine, and the collective and adaptive surrender to the earth as our master. Diversity is the struggle to minimize hierarchies and banish prejudices in the selfless effort to maximize life in harmony for the common good, making closed minds the true minority. What is called self-awareness is really the awareness of all, and our role as a part of all. Beneath the trappings of training for a particular society and in a particular body lies common ground where flexible humans fundamentally agree, where they are one, where the struggle for awakening and productive communing is waged. This awakening or empowerment, this elimination of suffering, cannot progress without its conscious pursuit, without deliberate self-diminishment and deliberate elevation of others in pursuing spiritual equality and material justice. Massive popular demand for change through positive activism will recognize in this challenge its natural allies, that nearly every nation on earth deplores America's tyrannical government, that the majority of Americans are good people who simply require a unified and empowering awakening, and that the planet's increasing rejection of empire's impact puts Earth itself on our side as the awakening device. Obvious immediate solutions, if we had a choice, might include banning think tank and corporate lobbying and corporate personhood and standing armies, reforming the banking industry, crushing the Federal Reserve, and diverting excess wealth. But these are almost irrelevant, as the earth will soon shudder and reform the human condition, if not banish us altogether. In the age of the end of empire, America is its last vestige, the most selfish construct on earth. In the process of the end of empire, there comes a time when the illusions and falsehoods of the ruling elite become like an old and irreparable shoe, neither fit to wear in the light of dawning realities, nor useful in the expediency of the forward march of life. To use a different metaphor, there comes a time when the passengers of empire's crumbling slave ship, with its human cargo chained to the anchor, must together and with wisdom free themselves, fashion a new vessel out of faith, and set course towards community, partnership, and life in balance with nature. This will become a clear choice to many Americans as the effects of global climate change and the depletion of resources come home to impact their lives. In the final throes of the end of empire, in fashioning a lifeboat fit to endure Earth's tortured, irritable seas, the new course must be substantial, built of an understanding of history and of faith in transcendence, generating a brilliance based on a deliberate choice against failed frameworks in favor of the timeless safety of cooperation in the Earth's embrace. As it rejects the plague of empire, nature provides proof that we must awaken to our silent complicity as consumers and followers of traditions of conflict and disunity. We will no longer see ourselves as special because of wealth, but because we realize wealth does not make us special. Our sins of statecraft will compel a new responsibility for caretaking an equal world, for sharing a new wealth of spirit, for building a lasting legacy that will absolve us of these sins that have caused untold suffering, to avert extinction. Humans can only be special in acting out the desire to transform the suffering of so many into harmony for all. And we're going to leave it with that positive vision. I would love to hear more such. When you consider how much energy, how much metal is consumed by the so-called defense industry, who are we defending ourselves against? People of the world, my eyes have nothing to fear. Are we that afraid of each other? Any kind of rational analysis would note how many dozens of times you are more likely to die in your bath or struck by lightning. Never mind things like cancer or car crashes. We don't get this discussion from those who would control us, from the corporate media. I'm encouraging you, if you still are a corporate media user, to turn it off, put the junk down, and enjoy real life. I'm preaching to the converted, I suspect, but perhaps you have friends who still watch television, even browse to BBC web pages. I've cut this all out because the longer I've worked on WikiSpooks, the more I've become aware of just what we're not being told. Planes crashing with tons of cocaine and government connections. Oh, I don't think that's newsworthy. No, best not go near that. So if you've got any spare time, I would encourage you to make an account at WikiSpooks and start to document what is actually going on and draw people's attention to it. And if you'd like to download this, perhaps play it to somebody, get another opinion. This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Big Brad and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.